From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Santa in the Parlor by Stephen Grendon. After 7 years of profound silence, surely a length of time sufficiently long to have encouraged hope for the worst, Ernest Ambler made it plain to his uncle, Theophilus, that he was not, after all, dead, lost in the wilds of South America, as he put it, but not permanently. His letter was followed by his peace offering, and no doubt the old man reflected pessimistically. His peace offering would in all probability shortly be followed by Ernest himself, and there would then begin once more the problem of waiting upon Ernest's letters just long enough to allow his real self to assert control, after which Ernest would need to be packed off to some remote place all over again. Circles, rather. "I may very well be a crusty old curmudgeon," said Theophilus to the single servant who waited upon him in his gloomy old house on Main Street in the southern town of Euphoria. "But naturally, I couldn't believe it, could I?" "Of course not," he went on replying to his question, precisely as he had replied to his own questions for half a century gone by. "Nor do I need Ernest to remind me. What a curse on my old bones to have to deal with Ernest once, twice, thrice, and God knows how many times. Get his room ready, Fulton. And what was in that box? I noticed you took the stamps off for your cousin's girl. I hope her collection is growing." "It is, Mr. Ambler, very much. Thanks to you, partly." "The box, Fulton?" "Yes, sir. A small object." "Yes, it was, wasn't it? Oh, forgive me. You meant its content. I referred to the box. My error. A small object, now? What kind of object?" "It was a shriveled something. Rubbery." "Where is it?" "Over on the mantel. I thought perhaps it was meant to belong with your collection of ivory and ebony pieces." Theophilus Ambler meandered over to look at his nephew's peace offering. He was a tall, thin man, but not cadaverous so much as anemic-looking. Still, despite his 70-odd years and only a little absent-minded, he put on his pince-nez and peered. The peace offering stood between an ivory elephant and an ebony rook, looming larger than either. Brown, shriveled, rubbery indeed, with a resemblance to a monkey's head. It was not nice to touch. He swept it off the mantel in the palm of his hand and held it forth into the sunlight streaming through the French windows. "Ernest will never change," he said. "I suppose he would call it a sense of humor." "What is it, Mr. Ambler?" "Damn it, man. You might have seen it for yourself. It's a human head. Shrunken, of course. Probably hero in origin. They call these things Santas. There are still headhunters down there, I suspect. Doesn't seem to be Ernest's head, though. Much too dark. An Indian, probably. It's an odd gift, isn't it? Only Ernest would think of it. And what the devil am I to do with it? I don't know." "No one would notice it among those pieces, sir. That's why I put it there." Ambler smiled and replaced it. "Good enough. Now let me have his letter again. I think it's in the pocket of your robe, sir." "Oh, yes, so it is." He took it out and read it slowly aloud, while Fulton stood in almost obsequious attention. "Dear Uncle Theophilus, like a bad penny I am turning up again. It now seems quite possible that I might be in the States again within a few weeks or months. Events will determine that. And I should like to see you, naturally. I hope all is forgiven. Under separate cover, I am sending you a little curio which you might like. I picked it up not long ago and thought of you immediately. My best wishes, Humph.
Best wishes, indeed.
That is an ambiguous letter, in my opinion. But of course, Ernest never wrote anything straightforward in his life, or spoke it either. How long ago was it written? 3 weeks, I suppose we can expect them any day.
I'm afraid so, agreed Fulton.
Fulton drifted out of the room and Theophilus was left alone. He made a determined effort to put the unpleasant thought of his nephew from his mind and settled down to read. But Ernest persisted. Ernest, who had never been a very pleasant child, and who had made life miserable for practically everyone, relative or friend, with whom he had been associated. How long will it be before I have to get rid of him, or get him out of another scrape? He wondered. He was really getting too well along in years for that sort of thing, he felt. Not really doddering yet, of course, but still no longer young. And Ernest, who must now be well into his 40s, was old enough by this time to know what responsibilities meant. But he knew in his heart that Ernest would never be old enough for that. In the night, the house creaked and groaned in the wind. Rafters cracked, and the bushes around the old building whispered in the hushing night air. Theophilus Ambler went to his bed not long after sundown, and Fulton went shortly thereafter. The old house was thus quickly lulled in darkness, and the sounds it made were long familiar. Mice scuttered in the attic, making their intimate small patterings. Theophilus had come to welcome them. He slept to their footsteps, and no creak or crack or groan invaded his sleep. But this night, a new sound flowed through the house. Theophilus woke to it at last. He lay for a while listening, and decided finally that it must be Fulton talking in his sleep, or grumbling. He sighed and waited for the sound to subside. But it did not subside. So Theophilus dragged himself out of bed, got into his slippers and dressing gown in the dark, put it over to a candle, lit it, and held it before him to light his way into the hall. He went down to Fulton's room, opened the door and looked in. Fulton's face caught the flickering candlelight. Theophilus listened. No sound, nothing whatever from Fulton. Fulton lay in peaceful sleep, as quiet as a tired child, and a child he is sometimes, reflected Theophilus wearily, withdrawing again and closing the door. He stood there in the shadowed hall listening. Certainly there was a voice somewhere. Since it was not Fulton's, it must belong to someone else. A faint prickle of perturbation made itself evident. No one else should be in the house, and the sound came from inside. The wind would have whipped beneath, away from anyone beyond the walls. Thoughtfully, Theophilus blew out the candle. He felt somewhat more secure in darkness, without the light to offer himself as a target for any possible invader. But who would invade the house? And for what? For there was nothing of value in any part of it. And what potential burglar would announce himself so carelessly? The darkness enfolded him. The darkness enclosed him in an uncertain security. He went noiselessly back along the hall to the head of the stairs. The sound came from below, steadily. But what was it? A muttering? Or a tittering? A short gibberish or an incoherent series of mouthings, scarcely human? And yet, now and then, it seemed there were guttural words. Ambler listened, straining himself to detach and isolate recognizable sounds. And presently, slowly, word by word, fragments of a sentence fell into his consciousness, and he put them together painstakingly while the darkness pressed about him with false security. "And this house is Mr. Ambler." The darkness concealed menace. The terrible muttering from below gave birth to alarm. Ambler was not afraid, but he was not inclined to dare the unknown without weapons and without some knowledge of what he might face. He felt instinctively that something dreadful lurked in the darkness below. "Bite," said the gibbering voice. "Bite," came the muttering. "Bite," rose out of the incoherent sounds from below. "And these house," it said again. And what a horrible tittering sound. How primitive, thought Ambler in some confusion. His confusion was, however, controlled. He made no betraying sound. Whatever it was menaced him, he was sure. The silence which fell was as sudden as it was unexpected. It made Theophilus Ambler even more uncomfortable than the sounds. But what came after was even worse than that sentient darkness. A new sound now, an incredible sound. Someone weeping, someone sobbing. Ambler stood there listening unbelievingly. What in God's name had gotten to the house? He felt his skin crawl. He felt something gnawing at the pit of his stomach. He felt in turmoil and a wretchedness of undefined fear and a kind of sick loathing, for the sound was so piteous that it was revolting. The sound of grief diminished, fell away, was gone, and the silence came. In a little while, the familiar signatures of the old house began once more. Serenely, the creaking and cracking and groaning, the wind's hush-hush at the eaves, the comfort of mice scampering about overhead. Theophilus Ambler retreated noiselessly to his room, where he sat for a long time listening and wondering, before he brought himself to put off his slippers and dressing gown and return to bed. He considered inquiring next morning of Fulton whether he had heard anything in the night, but thought better of it. If Fulton had heard, he would find some opportunity to mention it. If he had not, there was no need to alarm him. That would come soon enough if the experience persisted. Nevertheless, Theophilus Ambler made a thorough search of the old house. He turned up several articles which had been lost for years, but nothing at all to show that anyone had got into the house during the night. Every door and every window remained locked, just as they had been at bedtime the previous night. Moreover, nothing whatever was in any way disturbed. Could it have been that one of the Negroes from the other side of town had got drunk and wandered into the neighborhood, finding himself a corner somewhere outside the house, from which the sounds, despite the tearing wind, had reached in and through the walls? But no, hardly, that was stretching the bounds of probability too far. Yet it was undeniable that the sounds he had heard in the night might very well have been made by a black. Theophilus sat for some time in the horsehair-furnished parlor, ostensibly reading but secretly pondering the problem. With each hour that passed, his perplexity grew. More than once he gazed meditatively over at that curious peace-offering of Ernest, and at last he went to bring it out into a strong light so that he could examine it closely. Was it his imagination, or was the thing damp? He looked at it closely. It had once been a fine head, he decided, almost Nordic, save for its dark skin and the cut of the mouth. He fingered it judiciously. It seemed that some kind of teeth had been put into it, very sharp, too. The jaw seemed firm enough. He replaced it on the mantel. His improbable theory was clearly untenable, and he was left more puzzled than ever. Several times during that day he found himself regarding the hero leg with mixed emotions, uppermost among which was the impulse to rid himself of the object with summary dispatch. He waited for night with some apprehension. That night he lay in his dark bedroom at the head of the stairs waiting for untoward sounds, for no wind filled the old house with the familiar noise to which Theophilus had been so long accustomed. The clock struck 9. The clock struck 10. The clock struck 11. Outside, the town grew quiet towards midnight as the streets emptied and the last late crowd from the last picture show dispersed. Inside the old house on Main Street, the voice began again. Theophilus rose at once. He had not undressed, but had only put on his gown, in one pocket of which he had taken care to place a small pistol. He had put out a strong beam flashlight, feeling more secure with it in his hand than candles, and so, armed, he set out from his room, walking with every caution to the head of the stairs, and slowly, slowly down, step by step, careful to make no sound. The voice gibbered in the darkness. The voice complained, argued, cried, a horrible cacophony in the black well below. Near the bottom of the stairs, Theophilus paused. The atmosphere of menace around him was thick, unpleasant, cloying. Once again, there was audible words, disjointed, almost meaningless. Head of stairs, room in these house in third night. And again, gibberish, horribly intermingled with sounds of grief. And what was to be made of that? The sounds came from the parlor beyond any question. Mustering his courage, Theophilus tiptoed down the hall towards the old-fashioned portieres which marked the entrance to the parlor. In the silence which held the house, the sounds seemed twice and three times as loud as they were, so that at any moment Theophilus expected a distraught Fulton to appear at the head of the stairs, but there was no betrayal from above. He stood before the closed portieres listening. He heard a constant muttering, and paying careful attention, he detected a pattern of gutturals, words certainly, but not English, words in some alien language, phonetic, he decided, probably primitive, with now and then an English word. It struck him as very odd that the heavy accent of the English word, so similar to the less obvious accent Ernest had affected when last he had visited in Euphoria. His impulse was to retreat, but he would not yield to it. He did the second best thing. He effected a compromise. Rather than enter the parlor, he made a small parting of the portieres at the level of his eyes, thrust his flashlight into the opening, and focusing the beam on the mantel, switched it on. The ivory and ebony figure sprang into being, and a dark brown head, agleam as with perspiration there. It seemed to Theophilus Ambler that there was a burning of tiny eyes, movement of the shrunken lips, but the instant the light flashed forth, the sounds from within the room ceased. There was nothing. But wait. The head was not where he had put it. When last he had put it down, it was left standing next to an ivory knight. Now it stood before a teakwood box, fully a foot and a half away. Could Fulton have moved it? Hardly. Even if he had taken it up, he would have replaced it precisely where it had been. What then? The possibilities which occurred to him were not comforting. Theophilus was not unimaginative, but he was not inclined to accept the products of his imagination too readily. He looked across the room to the figures illuminated by his flashlight's beam. He could not rid himself of the conviction that one among them gazed back with malevolence. He snapped off the light and withdrew, allowing the portieres to close before him. He waited. Nothing happened. He was vaguely disconcerted. He had expected the gibbering and muttering to begin again, but no. No untoward sound came out of the parlor. Indeed, the room and the house were as one might expect them to be in the dead of the night. Theophilus walked back to the stairs. There he waited a while longer. Nothing took place. No unaccountable sound invaded the darkness. He went slowly up the stairs in the dark, with every step expecting to hear that weird voice again, but he heard nothing. All was as before, except that Fulton was snoring. "He's lying on his back again," thought Theophilus. He turned at the head of the stairs and looked back down into the well of black. He had a momentary feeling that someone watched him. He thought he saw a vague, shadowy figure, neck to toes, without a head. But he blinked and it was gone. More shaken than he cared to admit to himself, he re-entered his room. He considered blocking the door with a heavy easy chair in his room, but stoutly refused to give way to a fear so nebulous as that he now entertained. Just to be on the safe side, however, he slipped his pistol underneath his pillow, and presently he slept, after a fashion. The morning brought more than another day. It brought Ernest Ambler, looking, if possible, more dissipated than ever, with bags under his eyes and smoldering fire like a fever inside. He was of medium height, stoop-shouldered, and one might have said hawk-like in his appearance, except that it did injustice to a noble family of birds. His face was not so much prepossessing as it was fascinating in a revolting way. He looked and often acted like a character out of a painting by Felicien Rops, quite as if he had practiced every known major vice and quite a few minor ones. Theophilus found his nephew at breakfast when the old man descended. Ernest shot him an unsteady glance. "Hello, Uncle Theo," he said with false heartiness. "You're looking uncommonly well." Theophilus growled in acknowledgment. "And you're looking seedy, if I must say so. Puffy. It was a long trip." "I'll bet it was. How'd you make it? In steerage?" Ernest set forth his trip in patience. He made it commendably short. He had been working among the Hero Indians. He had sent up a sample of their work, but apparently it had not yet arrived. "I got it," said Theophilus shortly. Ernest seemed manifestly surprised. "Oh," he said. "Oh, you did." He licked his lips. "But surely, not very long ago, huh?" "2 days ago." "Then this is actually the third day you've had it, isn't it?" "Stupid question," thought Theophilus. "Small wonder," he chittered after it. Still, had that disgusting accent, too. "How the devil did you get along with the Indians, Ernest? Or can you speak their language?" "I learned it, and I taught some of them English. Oh, I taught them a lot of things, and they taught me. That head I sent you? I can do that sort of thing myself now, and a lot of others." "Equally reprehensible, no doubt." Ernest frowned angrily. "You would think so." "I know the precedents," answered Theophilus curtly. "How long are you planning on staying?" "Oh, not too long. A week or two, maybe. Then I must go back. I've got quite a reputation among those Indians." "I can imagine. You'll find it hard to believe, but they think I'm a big medicine man, the equivalent of an African witch doctor, no less." He was gloating. He was actually proud of what the Jivaro thought. Theophilus repressed a shudder. "Congratulations," he said dryly. "And tell me, Ernest, that head you sent me, did it take you very long?" "Oh, no, just..." Ernest caught himself and glared at the old man. "What do you mean?" "What did you think I meant?" countered Theophilus blandly. Ernest swallowed. "You always think the worst of me," he muttered. "Ah, and whose fault is that?" Theophilus got up, leaning above his nephew. He had scarcely touched his coffee, but he no longer had any appetite for it. "If you're staying, Ernest, you take the room next to mine. I have to tell you, though, there appears to be somebody else in the house, besides Fulton and me. You'll find out about that in good time." Ernest stared after him with narrowed eyes. Theophilus was profoundly disturbed. He read his nephew's eyes. He read hope, hate, avarice. He read more. And how curiously Ernest had spoken. He was not cringing, as he had formerly done. He was not apologizing or begging. His was an attitude of watchful waiting, an almost irrepressible gloating straying from behind his feverish eyes. Theophilus continued to be upset at intervals throughout the day. So did Fulton. What with the way in which Ernest presumed to order him about, Ernest managed to surcharge the already troubled atmosphere of the house on Main Street with an explosive chaos. Moreover, as evening approached, Ernest began to get extremely fidgety, and at last, immediately after supper, rose and left the house, mumbling that he would be back later, and no one needed to be waiting up for him, as if anyone intended to do so. "The front door will be left open," said Theophilus, "and it would be just like Ernest to come in midst of a soliloquy from that thing in the parlor," he thought. He half hoped he would do so. But that night advanced without the disturbance of the past 2 nights. Theophilus listened for hours. When at last the clock struck 11, he was tense with listening. He heard the murmur of wind in the trees, the creaking of the house, the scuttering of the wind in the trees. And a quarter past the hour, a terrible clatter on the front porch, followed by an assault on the door, which opened and closed and permitted Theophilus to hear a succession of unsteady footsteps advancing down the hall. Earnest and drunk, Theophilus sighed. He might have expected that. He got up, pulling on his dressing gown. He opened the door of his room and stood there waiting, listening to Ernest stumbling through the hall up the stairs. He hoped that Ernest would find his own room. That hope, however, was not destined to be fulfilled. Seeing the open door, Ernest came into his uncle's room, lurched across to the bed, and flung himself on it. Disgusted, Theophilus walked over and touched him on the shoulder. Ernest looked warily around, bleary-eyed. Seeing Theophilus, his eyes opened wide and closed again tightly. "Go away," he muttered thickly. "Never was afraid of you. Living afraid if you're dead. Go away." Was it worth it? Theophilus wondered. If left alone, Ernest might go to sleep in a matter of seconds. If not, he might become obstreperous and insistently difficult. He stood there for a moment, feeling the chill of the night through the dressing gown. Then he gave up and went out, leaving the door ajar, so that he might hear if Ernest got up again. He could as easily sleep next door in the room assigned to Ernest as in his own, much as he disliked being routed from his own warm bed. He got into Ernest's bed, profoundly hoping that he might be able now to sleep without interruption for what remained of the night. He was. He woke up just as Fulton found him. Fulton, much agitated, his hands almost palsied. He woke quickly.
"Mr. Ambler, sir. Mr. Ernest, on your bed."
"Yes, of course, I let him."
"I'm afraid he's ill, sir."
"Drunk, damn him. Just plain beastly drunk." Fulton looked apologetically dubious.
"But the blood," he said faintly.
"Blood?" echoed Theophilus. He got up, forgetting his dressing gown, and walked in his nightshirt as fast as it was able to down the hall to his own room. Fulton had not exaggerated. There was quite a bit of blood emanating apparently from some puffy wound on Ernest's neck. Ernest himself was dead. Of that there was not the shadow of a doubt. His neck was torn and lacerated, but not fatally to Theophilus Ambler's untrained eye. "Call somebody," he said to Fulton.
"The undertaker?" ventured Fulton.
"And the sheriff, too. They'll want to ask questions. They always do." The sheriff came and asked a good many questions, particularly after a report from the county coroner was in. Ernest Ambler had died of poison, evidently administered through the wound in his neck. Curare, a poison well known to certain Indian tribes of South America. As for the wounds in his neck, clearly bites of some kind. Perhaps rats? What did Mr. Theophilus Ambler know about it? Theophilus was not of much help, but for the fact that he had not a shred of motive for wanting his nephew out of the way, it might have gone very badly for him and for Fulton. As it was, the absence of evidence failed to constitute anything positive. 2 or 3 times it was on the tip of his tongue to say something about that strange Santa on the mantle, but he wisely forbore. He might escape a barred cell for a padded one. At the first opportunity, however, he examined the bloodstains on the stairs, which the men from the sheriff's office had found. There were not many, and they ended halfway down the stairs. He went into the parlor. The Santa stood on the very edge of the shelf. There was a red-brown smear at one corner of its mouth. Theophilus had not a doubt but that if he sent away the pointed teeth from that monkey-like head, he would find the source of the curare which had killed Ernest. He had an understandable reluctance to do so. But something would have to be done about the thing on the mantle. For the time being, it could stay where it was, but not for long. Within a fortnight, The mail brought in a letter sent to Theophilus Ambler by the American consul at Cuenca, Ecuador. Did Mr. Ambler have in his possession a shrunken jivaro head recently acquired? And if so, could he send it post-haste to the consulate? The consul was sorry, but he had been plagued by a jivaro woman who had told them a long rigmarole and given him no rest until he sent to inquire. Her husband, whose headless body had been discovered in the garden behind a small house once occupied by Ernest Ambler, who had gone from there, had been murdered by someone, according to her, by Ambler, who had, so she told the council, she had learned from her husband's specter, performed certain ancient rites and sorcery over the head and dispatched it to a place in America to do a deed, after which the head would be returned. Now the ghost of the dead Indian appeared nightly to his wife, weeping and clamoring for his head. It was absurd, it was ridiculous. But the council hoped that Mr. Theophilus Ambler knew how difficult a council's life could be and might understand. Theophilus understood very well indeed. The Santa had been sent to do a deed. On the third night in the room at the head of the stairs, the incorrigible Ernest had counted on the Santa's earlier arrival. Fortunately, Theophilus was in a position to appreciate the irony of the situation, however incredible. He took no chances with the Santa. He packed it carefully and sent it by air to the American consulate at Cuenca.